The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
What do philosophers actually love?
Are sophomores really wise fools?
And what's so cynical about dogs?
We'll explore the existence of existentialism, the absurdity of absurdism, get meta with the physical, and explore pithy and profound aphorisms on this philosophical episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Safaris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we're getting a little philosophical on Words Unraveled.
Oh yeah, we're hoping to get to some big truths during this episode, not just about the world in which we live, but also about the words we use to describe the world in which we live and the philosophies that we use to try and explain it.
Yeah, we'll get a little skeptical, a little rational, a little stoic, a little cynical.
All of those, which we always are, of course.
Oh,
we always are.
Of course.
But let's start off with that word, philosophy, because it's got a literal meaning and it's not necessarily, I don't think it's intuitive what philosophy literally means.
It's kind of cute the way it's typically translated, right? It's love of knowledge or pursuit of wisdom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. So the philo on there is the same as you get at the end of words that have file on them. For some reason, I can only think of abominable words that end like that. Hold on. Francophile, people who like French people. So yeah, we've got love.
Philadelphia.
Oh yeah, a city of brotherly love. Although it doesn't actually mean that, does it?
It right, it means just city of love, but we okay. Have to make sure it's definitely heterosexual.
Oh, this isn't supposed to be a political episode. It's supposed to be a philosophical one.
Oh, but there's so much overlap there, right? The thing is, we did try to come here with like not particular, like classical philosophy and a little less like political philosophy and a little less religious philosophy, but it all ends up tied up in the same terms, at least.
We necessarily will have to talk about political philosophy and religious philosophy during the course of this episode.
Unfortunately, the question of like human existence does ultimately bring up the notion of deities, right?
Yes, it does. And people have certain ideas about how that existence should be carried out. And they aim to put that into action through politics. So,
of course.
There we go. Philosophy. So yeah, philo is the love bit. And then the sophy. Well, it means wisdom.
And it's the same that we see in sophism.
Yeah, of course.
Before we get to that, I want to note that philosophy in the Middle Ages was also a word for things like alchemy or occult knowledge or really any speculative science, the exploration of anything unexplained. And it is still sometimes described as the predecessor to hard sciences. It also had many entertaining letter salad spelling variants in Middle English, like it was spelled with F's and Z's and all kinds of things.
But we do have remnants of that much broader meaning of the word philosophy that we still use all of the time. If we talk about a PhD, right, a doctor of philosophy, we're not talking about them. It doesn't have anything to do with, you know, the more narrow discipline of philosophy. It just means the acquisition of knowledge, right? And the same if you've got an MPhil, you know, a master of philosophy. You didn't study philosophy necessarily. You just studied something that involves, you know, the attempt at acquiring knowledge.
Speaking of acquiring knowledge, and on the note of that sophos element, we get to sophism, right? And this has come up before because we talked about the word sophomore, which has a common explanation that isn't quite right.
Yeah, remind me of that one, because we don't really use the word sophomore in Britain.
Right. So that's your second year of high school or college, typically. And if you're a sophomore in high school or college, you may have heard it said that the word sophomore is derived from the elements sophos, meaning wise, and moros, meaning foolish. So you're a sophomore, you're a wise fool. That's funny and entertaining and very apt for someone who's in their second year of learning, but it's not entirely true. But the truth of it is also pretty cool, I think. It's that the first half of sophomore is ultimately from sophos, meaning wise, but the second half is not from moros, meaning fool. The first half is usually tied to sophism more than general wisdom. Ultimately, in many early colleges, especially in throughout Europe, your second year would be studying things like rhetoric and philosophy. And rhetoric is the piece that's connected to Greek sophists.
Right. Do you think that whole interpreting the moor as being sort of idiot or fool is just sort of transferred across from the meaning of oxymoron? You know, someone
Probably, they
really want this literal oxymoron, which is, you know, sharp and dull in the same word, right? Oxymoron isn't oxymoron. But I don't know, it just feels like that the etymology of one might have inspired the etymology of the other.
I think it was originally probably a joke, right? And then people were like, quoted it as truth. But a sophist in 5th century BCE Greece was a professional teacher who sold instruction in rhetoric, argument, and just civic behavior. The earliest uses of the word could describe a craftsman or a sage, but Protagoras is our first one, who became our itinerant intellectual who trained elite youths for public life in Athens.
And here we are in Greece, which is where we absolutely need to be when we're talking about philosophy in ancient Greece. I mean, who does it start with, really? It starts with Socrates and Plato. You know, Socrates never wrote anything down. All that we know about Socrates is from, you know,
it's from Plato for the most part.
From Plato and Xenophon. Yeah, what they wrote about him. So, you know, he may not have said a single thing. It might all have just been Socrates making him say the things that he wanted him to say, but perhaps not, and probably not. But I was looking up Socratic reasoning and the Socratic method. Have you ever like engaged in the Socratic method?
It's questioning, right? It's yeah. Allowing someone, asking people questions and having people explain themselves into a hole often.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because the final stage of it is called aporia, which basically means puzzlement. So yes, you raise a premise. Well, you know, person A raises a premise. Person B finds an exception to it that means it can't be correct. And then person A then has to reformulate it. And you go on like that until you really, yeah, like you say, you end up in quite the hole.
What's kind of cool about the way Greeks approached philosophical discussion is it ultimately shaped the way we A, argue, including on the internet these days. And then it also shaped the way advertising approaches persuasive reasoning. Like right. The sophists, for example, they were big into rhetoric. A famous one was, I think it's Gorgias is how you pronounce his name? Or is it Gorgias?
Gorgias.
Right. I think it's actually Gorgias. Either way, he spoke in this highly patterned rhythmic style that drew attention to sound and structure over content. So he had a few different like word nerdy ways of approaching rhetoric. One of them is called isocolon, which is a device where successive clauses have equal length or similar structure. So we see that today in buy one, get one. And he also relied on antithesis, where you place opposite ideas next to each other to heighten contrast. Cicero wrote, "I defended the public as a young man. I shall not desert her now that I am old." So you do one and then the other. And we also, like, even AI picks up on this. It's not this, it's that, right?
Oh, yeah.
So this continues to exist. The thing about the sophists is they were focused on rhetoric, but they were also considered philosophers, but then they were not horribly maligned, they kind of deserved it. So they had a reputation for basically making bad faith, dumb rhetoric arguments that undermined people without making any real point. So they became known for basically selling advertising language as we might put it today.
They're accused of sort of superficiality.
Yes, which is why like sophistry is not considered an attractive trait today.
I see. Oh, that makes so much sense now.
Interestingly, sophomore and sophist are also related to the word sophisticated. Being sophisticated wasn't originally a good thing. It meant mixed with a foreign substance or impure, like mixed messaging and the convoluted logic of a sophist.
Tell me about some more of these sort of schools of philosophy, because some of them have got very boring names. They're just named after a person.
Right.
Which one am I thinking of? Epicureanism, just named after Epicurus. Boring. But there's some much better stories than that.
Boring, but he was also semi-affiliated with hedonism. Like Epicureanism and hedonism aren't the same. One centers pleasure, but then they mean different things by it. Hedonism means pleasure. That's kind of fun. They focused on immediate sensory pleasure as being a positive.
Yeah. I mean, Epicureanism is basically the pleasure is the only thing that really matters, the only thing that intrinsically matters.
The highest goal of Epicureanism is ataraxia, meaning freedom from disturbance, and aponia, meaning absence of bodily pain. But then the hedonists took it a little bit further, saying the only intrinsic good is pleasure, which wasn't just the absence of pain, but positively enjoyable sensations.
Right.
And which is why hedonism is sexy.
Yeah. Well, as opposed to Epicureanism, which does, though pleasure is important, accepts that like tranquility and moderation are also, you know, actually the roots to the most sort of tranquil life.
It's not really the opposite of that, but like cynicism ended up involving kind of a giving up many of life's pleasures.
Yeah, and that has got one of the most surprising, I think, etymologies actually that we've ever spoken of, because it's come up before. It's just related to a word that you wouldn't expect it to be related to.
Dog.
Dog.
Or not related to the word dog, but for the Greek word for dog.
Indeed, yeah. Although I think probably if we trace it back far enough, we find a way that it is related to dog. Certainly related to hound. It is related to hound. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So why were they called the dogs?
It's a matter of debate. It could have been a reference to their lifestyle. They lived a coarse ascetic life like a dog, according to the Greeks, living on the streets and things like that. This all came down to Antisthenes' credo that all one needs in life is virtue and strength of spirit, and that ill repute is a good thing and much the same as pain. Or it could have been a reference to where they hung out, which was called the Kynosarge, or the Gray Dog, which was a gymnasium, originally a place where you would study or practice things near Athens.
Yeah. Okay. So if they were meeting at a place called the dog, essentially the dog, they
the
were
like dog.
The dogists. Yeah. Well, if it is all about where they met, then we should mention Stoicism next, which is kind of fashionable in certain quarters at the moment. It's from the Greek stoikos, meaning a porch, because the founder, a guy called Zeno, Z-E-N-O, he lectured on this, a very ornate porch, you know, painted with murals. And it was at the Agora in Athens. And that Agora also means like a meeting place, and is, you know, where our word agoraphobia comes from, which is essentially a fear of large spaces where a lot of people could meet. Right. But yeah, the Stoicism comes from that word meaning porch. I think Zeno's like the most famous Stoic. It's interesting they didn't name it after him. I was reading a thing saying that they just thought that maybe he was flawed, and therefore they didn't want to attach the entire philosophy to Zeno himself. But the most famous Stoicist is probably Marcus Aurelius, right? The Roman emperor, who wrote Meditations. And, you know, he just set out all of his private thoughts on how to be more virtuous, you know, and immune to temptation. And that is where we get a lot of our modern ideas of what it is to be stoical. Sort of, what's a good word for the way we interpret stoicism now? I mean, I tied in with the idea of a stiff upper lip sometimes, or you know, not showing too much emotion,
being sort of reserved, but also reserved in the face of drama or pain or whatever else.
It's really about rationality, though, ultimately, isn't it? It's about logic, which is a word we should maybe go into. It's about, you know, applying the facts, not the emotions, to the situation.
Logos, of course, is the Greek word meaning word or account or reason, depending on the context. And it's the rational order of the cosmos and the rational faculty within human beings.
Those multiple meanings of logos, meaning, you know, reason and also word, is why we have so many logies and ology words that you go, here it seems like it means words associated with that, and here it means thoughts associated with that. Well, that's because study of, yeah, that's because that Greek word is kind of versatile.
It goes along with it. Well, I guess this is more in persuasion, but ethos and pathos, ethos being credibility or character, from which means like character or custom or disposition. And then pathos, which is the appeal to emotion, all of which are associated with Socratic method and then just rhetoric as a whole.
Then you've got ethics as well, which isn't a million miles off, is it? Right. Which is the name of the name given to a treatise of Aristotle, right? The you know, who's, you've got Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. That's the order they come in.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, one of his treatises gets labeled as Ta Ethica, in Greek, and that's where it comes from. It's a list of sort of moral principles from Aristotle.
Similar to metaphysics, which we talked about in a previous episode about the prefix meta, which now we use to mean sort of beyond, but that wasn't really what it meant in Greek. The reason it became that is because Aristotle's Ta Meta Ta Physica was a work that was literally titled The Thing After the Physics, because he wrote the physics first, and that was it, the first treatise, and then he wrote the thing that came after the physics.
Yeah,
and over time, that after shifted to beyond.
Yeah, but there is also sort of a sense, isn't there, that you should cover the physical and the material first, and then cover the philosophical later as well, which kind of helps with that idea.
He describes in this work the study of being, right?
While we're talking about all these people, by the way, I was wondering why we talk about Platonic love and like what Plato actually said about love. What's Platonic love? It's basically, you know, friendship,
right?
Non-sexy love.
So what does that have to do with Plato, who wrote extensively about sexy love?
Well, exactly. I somehow drawn from his Symposium. You know, it's intellectual love.
In the Symposium, there are several pieces where Socrates is arguing with people about the highest form of love or what kinds of relationships are the most meaningful.
I mean, I've looked up a lot of these words, but I haven't read any of these texts. I have to put my cards on the table and say this. I didn't study philosophy, and this is all new to me, but it's interesting how the words do reveal information about the philosophies as well.
Right. I haven't read the Symposium since high school, but I do remember some of the arguments within it.
I did read Marx at university, which I think you're supposed to read at university. We said we were not going to talk too much about politics, but you know, Marxism is a philosophy, and it's also a political philosophy, and it's worth talking about maybe just a handful of those, because I think it's quite interesting to see how close our modern interpretations of the terms are to what they originally meant. You know, mm-hmm. Liberalism is such a fraught term now.
Liberalism doesn't mean the same thing as liberal, doesn't mean the same thing as neoliberal in the United States.
Right. So what does neoliberal mean these days?
Neoliberal means capitalist, basically, right? It's free market,
free markets,
capitalism.
Right, exactly.
Deregulation, privatization, reduced government, which is the opposite of what they call liberal beliefs.
Yeah, exactly. But if you get called a liberal, right, a lefty liberal or whatever, I mean, it's something completely different. It's an ultimate idea that people should be able to do what they want. So it means that people at complete opposite ends of a political spectrum can fall under the same umbrella and even throw a term that can be applied to them at someone else as an insult. Yeah. It's madness. It's madness.
Dizzying.
Conservatism is another interesting one as well, because we talk about big C conservatism and big C conservative and little C conservative. And now in Britain, I've always thought of that as being, well, you know, big C conservative is a member of the Conservative Party, which is spelt with a big C, because you can be absolutely politically conservative without being
a con- conservative.
Obviously conservative, like some sort of Victorian. I know that's a stereotype about the Victorians or not, but ultimately conservatism is concerned with conserving, right? Is it about maintaining things as they are, sort of resisting change, which actually political conservatives are not necessarily averse to change.
I would say the distinction we end up getting over here is between conservatism and conservationism, which is very much a more, especially when it pertains to the environment, is a more left-wing priority.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? Whereas etymologically speaking, they're
basically identical.
same thing. I was also looking up republicanism. Now, I realize now that I've just listed liberalism, conservatism, and conservatism even, and republicanism, that it seems like I'm just delving into American politics, which I genuinely was not doing. I was looking at these sort of terms, because these terms are all relevant in one way or another in Britain as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, republicanism is a movement to not have a monarchy.
To have a republic.
or, in Ireland or Northern Ireland, it's the movement to be part of the Republic of Ireland rather than part of the United Kingdom. But I was just looking up where it comes from. And it's from the Latin res publica, right? And the res means affair, and publicus obviously means public. So it just means affairs of the public, which I think is kind of interesting.
The United States is structured originally as a democratic republic, a representative republic.
But there's nothing actually in there that's in that etymology that speaks to the idea of
left-wing or right-wing.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously it's affairs of the public, but it doesn't necessarily imply that the public should be in charge, right?
Right.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
All of these political philosophies are absurd, right? Which also has very little to do with absurdism.
Oh, very good. I was going to say, well, that's a bit of a big statement. Oh, it's okay. It's a pun. It's a pun. It's fine.
So, Phyllis...
Tell us about absurdism.
So philosophical absurdism is related to existentialism. It holds that human beings pursue purpose and coherence and justification while the universe offers silence, arbitrariness, and no final explanation. It's just permanent tension that doesn't have a solution.
Ooh.
So okay. It's often been associated with Camus and with the myth, with Sisyphus, basically rolling the stone up the hill. In short and very reductively, he meant that everything we try to do is relatively pointless.
Oh, great. Okay.
But the word absurd has some absurdity baked into its etymology. And it's also a little bit ableist, but its Latin elements are the prefix ab, which means off or away, and sordus, which was an adjective primarily used to describe people who were deaf or nonverbal. So Why does absurd mean illogical or ridiculous, or in the context of absurdism, why does it mean that it stuff doesn't matter? And there are two explanations. In Latin, the full word absurdus meant the same thing as the English word does today and was used to describe silly and improper behavior. But at the same time, it was used to describe a sound or a bit of music that was out of tune or discordant, kind of goofy and wrong. So one explanation is that absurd was meant to imply that something is out of harmony with what's normal or reasonable or proper, or something that was tone deaf, but like literally tone deaf.
Right. So almost like abnormal.
Yeah, exactly. But there's also some linguists have a more interesting and almost punny explanation because the Latin sordus was applied to both someone who cannot hear and someone who is not heard. The term absurd could be said to describe things that are literally unheard of because they are so illogical and ridiculous.
Right, yeah. So that is punning, right? So yeah, it's kind of applying a modern term. Modern English term, unheard of, right?
Because it has been used in comedy for so long, that's also feasible. It sounds like too neat of an explanation, but that logic does go back to Latin.
That's absurdism. Do you have nihilism there as on your list?
I do. It means nothing. Yeah. Nothingism.
Yes, of course, because it appears in that made-up word, doesn't it? Flocky-nocky nihilification, right?
Which yes. Is
this, to esteem something as worthless because it's just a pile of terms meaning nothing or of no value, and nihil is in there, which is where nihilism comes from.
We interestingly get this from like German and Russian philosophers for the most part.
Oh, really? I the Berlin winter's pretty rough.
Like Jacobi and Turgenev, I would say, are the nihilists that I typically think of. The idea is it's the view that the world and especially human existence is without meaning, purpose, or comprehensible truth. So it's a little more intense than absurdism. It's like what you're doing is pointless, but existing is still enough. Whereas nihilism is like, nope, doesn't matter.
And existentialism is, of course, another approach altogether as well, isn't it? So existere, right? The Latin that the word exist comes from, it doesn't really mean what we think of it as meaning. It doesn't mean just sort of being. It's got, like, literally, when you pull it apart, it has quite a sort of dramatic meaning that almost means like to sort of rise from the dead, right? It's
like stand out.
We have all the time is to out. Yes, exactly. It does mean literally to stand out, but as if you were in the grave and you stood up out of it again. It's to present yourself, you know, in a less spooky way, but it does mean just to stand out. Stere, right? And indeed, it's related to the word stand, I suppose.
It was a reaction to the notion that, like, humans have a divine purpose, whereas this is, like, existence is more important and comes before, like, the essence of humanity.
Okay. I'm learning a lot.
Yes. In Aristotle wrote, I'm probably doing a lot of this badly. I'm sure we're going to be corrected and I look forward to learning more, but
this is going to be one of those ones where the comments section is going to be more informative than the video, but that's okay 100%. With us. That's okay with us.
We're here for the words, not the think pieces. In Aristotle, the essence of a thing came first. A thing had like a defining nature and its actions followed from that nature. And so Sartre, for example, reverse the order for human beings. Humans first find themselves existing and only afterward define themselves through their choices and actions. I'm the worst because if I had to pick a philosophy, I'd go with eclecticism, which is where you can pick whatever you want.
the philosophy for the indecisive.
Uh-huh. I like that part of that one and that part of that one.
Yeah, that's fine. I just call myself, you know, Robism. My Robism just... Just rolling with it.
Zafarism.
Just keeping it real, rolling with it.
Oh, I like it.
Zafarism's quite good. I could subscribe to Zafarism. Can I take a sidestep to an English word? Because we've been talking about an awful lot of Greek and Latin here. But do you know that belief, you probably do actually, I should ask this to a normal person. The word belief, it's not supposed to start with a B.
No, actually, I don't know this.
Oh, okay. Well, you're going to love this because belief used to be spelt with a Y or an I or a G pronounced like a Y. It's elief. And for a long time, the word just was elief. But the B gets put on there because it's just a more credible sounding prefix. But it's related, so this is a real surprise to me. The German for believe is glauben, right? And I thought, oh, but that just seems like a completely different word to believe. But when you realize that the y sound in Old English is spelt with a G, then you realize that glieve and glauben are actually very close to one another. There's words across the Germanic languages along the lines of the German Glauben and the English, the old English, I mean old English, but also like Middle English, elive, that mean our word believe. And that's because believe is essentially a corrupted version of that word.
The root, the Proto-Indo-European root, means to care, desire, or love. So it's related to the word love and libido.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, absolutely it is.
It's also related to a Sanskrit word meaning to make people, make you crazy. To make someone crazy.
Yeah, well, this came up in our sexy episode recently. I did say that love and libido are related.
That's right,
and then confusion in Sanskrit also means, what is related to our word for love. But yeah, you've got this believe. So the bar gets put there for goodness knows what reason. And the ending, because it was spelled Y-L-E-V-E, right? But we spell it the way we spell it. Probably influenced just by the word relieve, right? Because it sounded like relieve. So that's how it ends up being so far away from the other Germanic words like Glauben and such. But there you go. Believe should start with a Y.
Incredible. That resonates neatly, the connection between belief and love connects nicely with poetic notions and maybe even like religious notions as well.
Poetic notions like aphorism?
Yeah.
So that was me just trying to direct us towards something else that I've been doing some research on, which is aphorism, which are sort of, little snippets of philosophy.
Tidy ways to express modes of thinking.
Yeah. There's a very specific definition of an aphorism, how it's different from just, any old proverb or saying or whatever. Because an aphorism, you can usually attribute to a specific person who said it, like a proverb, which is kind of a received wisdom. And they're supposed to have like a sting in the tail. They require some thought. They don't give you the solution, but they tell you a thing that allows you to get there. Here's a really nice aphorism. It's from a guy called Wiesław Brudziński. He's a Polish aphorist. And I heard about this from a guy called James Geary, who is an American aphorist. And he says, "The most difficult thing to find is the way to the signposts," which I really like. It's not telling you, that statement itself is not, all that wise, but it is if you consider it as a philosophical statement.
I remember when studying philosophy in, say, high school and college, every philosopher kind of has an aphorism that you can use on your flashcards, right?
Right.
The unexamined life is not worth living is the Socrates association, and man is the measure of all things is Protagoras, things like that. I think, therefore I am, for Descartes.
Yeah, of course. Cogito ergo sum. I don't know if it's apparent to people that the ergo, when we say ergo, is the same as the one in cogito ergo sum.
Yeah.
Therefore. Yeah, there are a lot of sort of much more modern aphorists as well, though. I mean, Benjamin Franklin was quite the aphorist.
Oh, and he's darling.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great friend of the podcast, great friend of anyone who likes words, really, with his quirky attempts to revamp the alphabet and the English language more widely. But he said, "Better slip with the foot than tongue," which I like.
Oh, that's fun. Yeah, I do a lot of both, but I definitely do more with my feet than my tongue.
Here's one for, feels like one for our times. "He that lies down with dogs shall rise up with fleas." Careful who you hang out with. And then just I've got to say, a lot of sort of American poets make for very good aphorists. Robert Frost, "Good fences make good neighbors."
Yes, indeed.
But maybe the ultimate sort of poetic aphorist of the past couple of centuries is Emily Dickinson, who would write entire poems that were aphorisms. Can I read you one?
Please.
Because this one is just rammed full of, so it's kind of the same point made over and over again, but each time in a very colourful and clever way. One of her poems is, "A wounded deer leaps highest. A wounded deer leaps highest, I've heard the hunter tell. 'Tis but the ecstasy of death, and then the break is still." It doesn't work in my accent. You should be reading this. "The smitten rock that gushes, the trampled steel that springs, a cheek is always redder just where the hectic stings. Mirth is the mail of anguish in which it cautious arm, lest anybody spy the blood and your hurt exclaim." Sorry, my snotty, congested way of reading it. But there it's just repeated over and over again, the idea that, the most shining examples of things can come at the times of their sort of greatest adversity, like the wounded deer's last jump, or the, you know, that line about cheek is always redder just where the hectic stings. The hectic is consumption, mm-hmm. right? It's a sort of reddening from consumption. It's the idea that you sort of, your skin glows the brightest where it's most injured, where it's most hurt.
I love Emily's work. My favorite is, have you heard There Is No Frigate Like a Book?
No.
There is no frigate like a book to take us lands away, nor any coursers like a page of prancing poetry. This traverse may the poorest take without the without oppressive toll. How frugal is the chariot that bears the human soul. Basically, cheap treasure troves in books.
How frugal is the chariot that bears the human soul. Nice. And she also wrote, Forever is composed of nows, which is again just the first line of a poem, but is in itself an aphorism.
Yeah.
A strong one. Right, a strong one. Forever is composed of nows. Lovely stuff. I briefly mentioned him, James Geary. He's just written a book called The World in a Phrase, A Brief History of the Aphorism. And yeah, him that's, it sounds like it's worth a read. I was listening to an interview with him and he was saying, yeah, an aphorism has to have a sting in the tail. So it does have to be a little bit sort of cheeky, maybe. Cheeky's maybe not the word. It needs to have a sort of hard truth in it.
Aphorisms have sometimes been criticized for being overly reductive, right? We're trying to boil down these massive philosophical concepts into a pithy saying that we can repeat often at inopportune times. And so that's why, like, Polonius in Hamlet has his series of aphorisms, and he's considered, he's one of the most quoted characters from that work.
That's so funny, isn't it?
Right, because he's Shakespeare's literally saying that he is full of empty words.
Yeah, exactly. So, it was Polonius, he said. Well, don't listen to Polonius.
Right.
he's you know, an unthinking man who's just throwing out literally aphorisms. He's just throwing out proverbs and occasionally directly contradictory ones. Yeah, I mean, they are reductive, but you don't actually live your life by aphorisms. You just choose the aphorism that fits the moment you're in and that helps to explain the idea, the philosophy that you want to get across. Oh, I managed to work the word philosophy in it.
If anyone's trying to work out
why we're talking about aphorisms, it's because they're little philosophical statements.
They are often affiliated with philosophers who spoke different languages than us and lived in different times, but their wisdom can be translated through these more pithy phrases.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Chinese wisdom is from aphorisms. You think of Confucius says, you know, what comes next is an aphorism. You know, particularly if it's attributed to a specific person, it's an aphorism.
So before we close out this episode, I do think it might be fun to talk a little bit about a few parody philosophies or philosophies that are intentionally absurd.
Oh, great. I like the sound of these.
Often these are criticisms of religion, but they also tend to have a philosophical edge to them, like hard philosophical, I suppose you could say. And I'd say the most famous one would be Pastafarianism.
Pastafarianism.
Yes, the flying spaghetti monster is the deity of Pastafarianism, a parody religion created in 2005. So,
and why does it exist?
So, Bobby Henderson was a physics graduate from Oregon State University, and he wrote an open letter to the Kansas State Board of Education after it allowed intelligent design, the view that life requires an intelligent cause or a deity, to be taught alongside evolution in public schools. And he argued that if intelligent design qualified as science, then belief in a supernatural being made of spaghetti and meatballs should receive equal classroom time. And he described the monster as invisible, undetectable, altering scientific measurements with its noodly appendage. Although it's much sillier, it has predecessors. So, you know, Bertrand Russell's teapot. You could claim that there is a teapot orbiting Jupiter. There is a teapot there. And it is on, because we don't know that, it is on the person who claims the teapot is there to prove that there is, in fact, a teapot. A similar parody religion from the 90s, similar to the Flying Spaghetti Monster is the invisible pink unicorn, who is a satirical goddess invented in online atheist communities, particularly a Usenet group that was called Alt Atheism, as a parody of religious claims and notions of attributes. So the invisible pink unicorn is defined by her invisibility and her pinkness, which
right, contradictory,
right?
But that's the magic.
The notion is like supernatural assertions can be insulated from disproof by defining a deity or a ghost or something as undetectable, and then treating the lack of evidence as compatible with belief. By the way, I'm not challenging anyone's belief systems here. I'm just explaining what the philosophies say.
Yeah, because I'm actually a staunch Pastafarian, so never mind.
My apologies.
A little offended.
may his noodliness reign. Another one that has a lot more zaniness to it, is a little bit older, is Discordianism, which was a religion founded in the 60s. The idea is that order and disorder are human-made conceptual grids imposed on deeper, pure chaos. Later, a couple of other people published a series of Discordian-inspired novels called the Illuminatus Trilogy, which was this satirical, postmodern sci-fi influenced adventure story filled with drugs and sex and magic through conspiracy theories. And it involves the notion of Operation Mind, which, excuse me, in
might have bleeped that one.
In which they attribute all national calamities, assassinations, or conspiracies to the Illuminati. And this is where we started blaming everything on the Illuminati, which appeared many times throughout the 20th century. In the books, the interjection Fnord is given hypnotic power over the unenlightened, and children in grade school are taught to be unable to see the word consciously, and for the rest of their lives, every appearance of the word subconsciously generates a feeling of unease and confusion that prevents rational consideration of the text in which it appears.
Fnord.
Fnord.
It's like fjord, but with an nin.
So they can't hear that, or if they did hear it, it would trigger them.
You're asking me to explain this to a degree that I don't fully understand, but this is what I have read.
I think this episode has been about anything, about explaining things that we don't really understand.
When we were preparing for this episode, Rob said, what is it you said? People have spent their whole lives wrapping their heads around this. And I was like, they've also spent their whole heads wrapping their lives around it.
Very true. I was trying to get my head around it on a Monday morning with a cold. No. Thanks for bearing with me. And sorry everyone for the sinuses. But soldiering on, eh?
Maybe in the future. We mostly focused on European philosophies, so maybe we can delve into more global.
Don't promise that. Please don't promise that.
That just seemed hard.
It's just hard enough. I don't know, I have to learn Mandarin as well. Okay. Yeah, all right. Well, maybe we'll do something later. We won't. not if I've got anything to do with it. Thanks a lot for joining us this time round.
We'll see you next time on Words Unraveled.